design. Providence ordered the greatest and smallest events of men's lives. Providence controlled the workings of the universe, from the turning of the planets to the flight of a bird. Men might disagree about the meaning of the occurrences of their lives, some of which seemed surprising, even inexplicable. Early deaths, epidemics, droughts, plagues, wars, evil as well as good. Such things men might wonder at and even describe as judgments or afflictions or marvels or mysteries. Yet they did not doubt that these things had meaning. But the God who gave order to the world was not only seen in externals. He was felt, sometimes in the cool hush of Virginia churches, sometimes in quiet Quaker meetings, sometimes in the spare meeting houses in New England villages. Whether in the calm rationalism of Arminians, the unforgiving harshness of Calvinists, or the surging spirit of enthusiasts, the divine was felt. To some, the power of God seemed overpowering. To some, his grace gave relief, and to some, God's majestic meekness, in Jonathan Edwards's startling phrase, appeared to reveal the joining of his majesty and his mercy. Perhaps at some point in their lives, most men had a sense of the divine who gave meaning to the eternal order of things. Perhaps few sustained great religious passion for long, but they did retain faith in providential order. For most Americans, perhaps, providential order appeared most clearly in the progress of an increasing, flourishing people. They called themselves a thriving people and impressed European travelers with the ease and the zest with which they accepted their growth and success. They were not complacent. More than one European remarked on their enthusiasm, a word that suggested that they might be dangerous as well as filled with religious extravagance. Many observers called them prolific, meaning that they produced goods as well as children at a surprising rate. And more than one commented on their ragged money, as indeed it was from changing hands in the bustling markets of American business. Their increase in business and population did not amaze Americans, who had long had great expectations for themselves. To the heirs of people who had begun by thinking of themselves as settling the new world in the service of God, success, increase, and growth in the things of this world seemed only their just deserts, only their due, and a part of the eternal order of things. In the second half of the 18th century, that order still extended to the ordinary doings of life, and especially to work and family. Work seemed akin to the sacred. Work was a duty imposed by God and approved by Him as right and good. That everyone should have a trade or a calling was unquestioned. The trade should be worked at, the calling well followed, for as Franklin said, there is much to be done, and though you may be weak-handed, stick to it steadily and you will see great effects. To be sure, the higher purposes of these great effects were not so clear as they had once been, say, to the founders of the colonies. But the purpose of life was still the glorification of God. Teaching that proposition fell to all in authority and began with parents, especially fathers, who ruled the house and all in it. They were commissioned by God, and their word was law. They were responsible for much, for bread, for discipline, for seeing that others lived up to responsibilities, and for doing so themselves. The order that began with the divine and expressed itself in the lives of a people embraced their government. In the second half of the 18th century, no one in America regarded the crown as the immediate instrument of God. Yet royal government had the sanction of the Lord, and men accepted the existing structure of government without question, though they often protested against its agents whom they faced every day. The structure of government, they agreed, should reflect the structure of society. The good, the well-born, and the socially qualified should govern. That arrangement had apparently always existed and should continue. Maintaining it seemed all the more desirable to Americans because they knew that it conformed to the ancient lines of the British Constitution, the most glorious frame of government yet devised by man. The Americans marveled at the long history of the protection, indeed encouragement, that the British Constitution afforded to liberty. And it protected imperial liberty, the freedoms of Americans as well as Englishmen, a remarkable achievement when measured against the record of despotism in earlier empires and the tyranny that infected most of European life. This public life and private life, according to these widely shared assumptions, were a part of an inevitable and unchanging order. Yet what American colonials assumed seems to have flown in the face of the reality for which they professed such admiration. For in the New World, much was different, and a fresh, though